Is today Friday the 13th for President Trump's chances of actually becoming reelected and being sworn in on January 20th? The New York Times has done an analysis which suggests that's the case, that there is no path to victory. What are his lawyers advising him? My advice is you can do great things in the next 9 or so weeks of your presidency, even if you no longer contest the outcome of the election. Maybe that would be the way to turn a loss into a win. You'll hear more about this on The Dirt Show. Is today Friday the 13th for President Trump's chances of actually turning around the election results and being inaugurated on January 20th? Should his lawyers finally have that come to Trump moment and sit down with him and say, look, we've gone through all the states, we've gone through all the likely scenarios, and we've come to the conclusion that you have no path to victory. The New York Times did an analysis yesterday in which they came to the conclusion. Their title is, Can Trump Still Win? No, he's already lost. They've come to the conclusion, quoting lots of election experts, that even if he wins all of the cases that are now pending in the various courts, there just aren't enough votes that are being reasonably contested to turn around enough states to give him the 270 electoral votes. Now, of course, he doesn't need 260 electoral votes to win the presidency. The reason for that is that Joe Biden needs 270 electoral votes to win the presidency. If President Trump got no votes at all, or one electoral vote, or 10, but Vice President Biden got only 269 votes, not the 270, Trump would become the President of the United States. That's by dint of a strange provision in the Constitution that says that if no candidate wins the 270, they don't mention the term 270, but wins a majority, now we know that a majority with current populations is 270. If no candidate reaches a majority, that is, if Biden can't get beyond 269, then the matter goes to the House of Representatives, where each state gets one vote, and there are more Republican state delegations in the House than Democrat, and so Trump may very well become the president. But even that scenario now seems, if not impossible, extraordinarily difficult. This is the way the New York Times concluded its analysis. Even this theory relies on a series of 1 in 100 legal bank shots, all being successful in multiple states simultaneously. Now, President Trump has made quite a few bank shots. Winning the 2016 election took a lot of unlikely bank shots with the buzzer about to go off. But this time, the odds are so overwhelmingly against him. He will win in Pennsylvania the lawsuit challenging the votes that were received after Election Day was over, even though they were submitted before Election Day was over. Should he win that? Shouldn't he win that? That's not my issue today. The issue is what he will do. And if that case were to get to the Supreme Court, I think he would win that 5-4 based on the Bush versus Gore precedent, the current lineup of Supreme Court justices. The problem for him is that even if he wins those thousands of votes, we don't know exactly how many there are, it seems that they're considerably less in number than the margin of victory that Biden had over him. So it would be a Pyrrhic victory. The same is true in the other states. Yesterday, Arizona declared that Biden was the winner by 11,000 or so votes. You know, those are numbers that are rarely, if ever, turned around in recounts. The same is true in Georgia, where there will be a manual recount. And in other states where his lawyers are perfectly entitled to challenge and bring recounts. Again, I'm praising his lawyers, not condemning them for exhausting every conceivable legal and political remedy. You just don't give up the presidency of the United States, to be polite. You give it up only if you think you have no possible path to victory. Now, lawyers serve several functions. They advocate, and they're doing their job advocating. They're in court in Pennsylvania. They're in court in a number of other states. Lawyers play another role as well. I know, because I've played that role over and over again. We advise our clients, and it's the hardest sit-down you have with a client. I do it in the context of criminal cases. I have to sit down with clients occasionally and say to them, look, we have a really good case here. We have strong arguments. We have good evidence. But I have to tell you, the odds on you winning are very, very slight. Let me tell you a story that happened to me about, must be more than 10 years ago. A very prominent doctor was accused of Medicaid, Medicare fraud. He came to see me and he said he was offered a deal by the prosecution. He could get a suspended sentence, not go to jail, lose his medical license for 5 years and have to pay fines if he pleaded guilty. But if he contested the case and pleaded not guilty, the guidelines for sentencing were about 11 years. And they would recommend 11 years, and the judge would probably impose 11 years. So he had a choice. He believed he was totally innocent. And he had a good argument that he was totally innocent. But the risks of losing were 11 years in prison. But if he bit his lip and pleaded guilty, he would get no prison time, and perhaps he could get back to practicing medicine in about 5 years. He asked me to do a careful legal analysis of the evidence, and I did it. And I gave him my conclusion, and my conclusion was he had about a 40% chance of winning the case. And the guy said, great, 40% chance, that's a lot. Most criminal defendants only have a 5 or 10% chance of winning their case. And I said, it's not enough. It's not enough. 40-60 is not enough to risk 11 years in prison versus no time in prison. So I recommend that you plead guilty. He rejected my advice. He went to trial. He put up a very good defense, but he lost. And he got an 11-year sentence in prison. I was not his lawyer at trial because once he rejected my advice, I didn't want to be part of his case. But that's the kind of conversations lawyers have to have with clients. Now, in that case, in criminal cases, you get something back from pleading guilty, for conceding something that you don't believe happened, for saying you're guilty even though you believe you're innocent, even though you think that the prosecution against you is corrupt. You get something back. You get years. The problem with the advice that a lawyer might give President Trump is he gets nothing in return if he were to concede that Vice President Biden is now the official president-elect of the United States. What does he get in return? Well, let me make a couple of suggestions about what he might get in return. He would be able to devote his full attention in the next 2 months and slightly more to doing really good and important things. He could go back to trying to get more countries in the Gulf region and in the Middle East to normalize relations with Israel. He's done a fantastic job along those lines already, getting the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, the Sudan, to normalize relationships with Israel, getting Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, to even talk about normalizing relationships with Israel. That is a Nobel Peace Prize accomplishment. Indeed, I believe the Nobel Peace Prize, the event that warrants the Nobel Peace Prize this coming year, must be the peace process in the Middle East, the progress that Israel and the Gulf states have made toward normalization. That's the event that deserves the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Prize criteria say you have to look at who and which groups have done more to promote peace and disarmament in the world. Well, that event certainly is the number one event, and I think qualifies for the Nobel Peace Prize. So the only issue that's left is, if the event qualifies for the Nobel Peace Prize, which individuals should get it? And to me, there are two contending groups, both of which include President Trump. One would be the various heads of state, President Trump, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the emirs of the countries that normalized relationship. That would be a normal way of doling out the Nobel Peace Prize. That's what happened with the Oslo Accords and others, where Yasser Arafat got the Nobel Peace Prize along with Israelis, and when Jimmy Carter, who has not been a force for peace generally, but a cause of even greater tensions in the Middle East for his support for Arafat, he got the Nobel Peace Prize. And I'm not suggesting here that the Nobel Committee would actually give a peace prize to Donald Trump, but he and his group of people, Jared Kushner and David Friedman, the ambassador, and Avi Berkowitz, worked so hard to achieve the goals of bringing about a peace, Secretary Pompeo, all. So that would be another possibility. And so putting aside his personal ambitions and his personal pride that he would get in winning the Nobel Peace Prize, the accomplishment would be recognized as a signature part of his presidency. And he could do that, and he could improve and increase the effectiveness of the role he's played in peace in the Middle East. That would be a legacy that any president would be proud of. The other thing he could do is he could understand and act on the fact that pardons and commutations are an important part of our system of checks and balances. They're not just gifts given to friends and acquaintances and even people who deserve it. It's part of our system of checks and balances. The Constitution accords the executive branch, the President of the United States, the power to tell the legislative and judicial branches, you've gone too far. You've produced injustices. Pardons and commutations are there to correct injustices that are not capable of being corrected by the judicial process or the legislative process, or have not been corrected by the judicial and legislative process. And I know President Trump is interested in the pardon and commutation power, and he could use the next 2 months to give a large number of pardons and commutations to people who deserve it and people who have been treated unjustly by our legal system, by laws, draconian laws, which punish relatively minor violations with long prison terms, life imprisonment. The idea of the trial penalty that I just discussed. If you plead guilty, you get a small penalty, but if you plead not guilty, you get an enormous penalty. That's penalizing people for exercising their constitutional right to go to trial. He can help cure that problem by giving pardons to people who have been victims of the trial penalty. So there's so much he could do, and he doesn't have to essentially concede defeat. All he has to do is say, look, I'm told by my advisors that this election cannot be turned around by legal or political actions, recounts, or cases. I still think it was an unfair election. If he wants to say it was a stolen election, that's his prerogative. If he wants to talk about massive fraud, that's his prerogative. The evidence at the moment doesn't support that. Maybe there'll be some evidence coming out. He doesn't have to backtrack from those statements. All he has to do is say, look, there's no realistic chance that I'm going to win this. So I want to congratulate Vice President Biden for being elected, for being president-elect. I want to help in the transition. I want to do whatever I can. And he might want to even announce that he's going to run against in 2024, that he's going to run again, and he's going to run against then-President Biden. That's what Andrew Jackson did in 1824, 200 years ago, when he felt the election had been stolen from him by the corrupt bargain between Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams. He used that as a wedge issue in his campaign to win election in 1848, and he won overwhelmingly. So the president has that option. He can congratulate Biden, say, I have no chance of winning this election, but I want to win the next election. And I'm going to keep complaining about the processes. And I'm going to try to change the law, make it harder to do write-in ballots. Any of those things he has the right to do. We have the right to oppose it if we think that's wrong. I think write-in ballots, if properly conducted, help democracy, don't hurt democracy. But I'm laying out the options the president has. And one of the options he has now is to no longer contest this election. Doesn't have to admit he was wrong. He doesn't have to say that there was no corruption, that there was no fraud. All he has to do is say, I'm no longer going to take my next 2 months, etc., toward contesting the election. I am not contesting the election. I'm going to turn my attention to the Middle East, to the pardon process, to issues growing out of China, to other issues that develop in the world. He can say, I'm going to be a great president for the next 9 or so weeks, and then there'll be another president, and we'll watch him. We'll be the loyal opposition, and we'll run against him if you want to do that. Those are all available options. The only option that doesn't seem today available to him with any prospect of winning is to continue to challenge the election results. If the New York Times is correct, and it's often not correct, but if it's correct in its analysis and it goes through the numbers in each state, the numbers of ballots separating winner from loser, the number of challenge ballots, the likelihood of wholesale success, such as might very well occur in Pennsylvania, retail success, particular ballots thrown out in Georgia or in Nevada or in Arizona, those don't add up to the likelihood that this election will be turned around and that President Trump's fortunes will be reversed. So he has some hard decisions to make. I'm glad I'm not the lawyer who has to sit down with him and tell him the bad news. But there are lawyers, and there are White House staff people, and there are family members, and there are close friends, and there are associates who, with whom he has a long-term relationship, who can sit down and tell him the truth. And the truth is that absent extraordinary combination of events, that series of bank shots in so many states, Joe Biden will be sworn in on January 20th. And that you have so much time left between now and January 20th to do so much good for the American people, to do so much good for the world, that you should spend that time productively. Be a winner. You can be a winner if you spend the next weeks doing great things. And if you continue to contest the election and lose in the end, isn't it better off being a winner? And that's the message I would give him. He hasn't asked. That's the message I'm sure he's getting from some of his lawyers. Again, let me say, the job of a lawyer is twofold: to advocate like hell, to fight like anything you can, to win, but at the same time, to give an honest assessment to your client as to what the benefits and costs are of going forward. I've done that for 55 years. It's been very, very painful. It's like the doctor who reads the MRI and the CAT scan and has to come in and say to the patient, look, I'll try as hard as I can to get this tumor out safely, but I have to tell you, the chances of you surviving are very slight. Doctors owe their patients an obligation of honesty. Lawyers owe their clients an obligation of honesty. The media owes its readers an obligation of honesty. And I think an honest assessment at this point would lead lawyers and others who are in close proximity to the president to tell him that he can be a winner by spending the next weeks of his presidency really doing great things for America and for the world and for peace. So I'm not here taking a political position. I'm trying to do a careful analysis of the realities. That's what I do on the Durst Show. I'm interested in hearing your views on this. Do you think that the president's lawyers should tell him to stop challenging the election? Do you think the president's lawyers should tell him he has a good chance of winning? Should they tell him he has a very slight chance, but maybe he should go forward? What would you advise the president if he sought your judgment and your counsel? Call the Dirt Show, tell me, and maybe we can get that information to the president. So now we turn to you, our great callers, and hear your questions or your comments on the Dirt Show. Our first caller is from the contested state of Georgia. Sean.
Is what happens if the Electoral College Day rolls around in December and we still haven't resolved all of these legal battles over the vote count? Like, what happens if it's, I think it's December 14th, if the Electoral College goes to vote and there's still lawsuits pending in all of these states? Do those states just simply not get to send Electoral College representatives? Do we possibly end up with a scenario that nobody has 270 votes? How would all of this sort of work out? So I'm anxious to hear your answer.
Create a lot of opposition among American voters, but it's not beyond the realm of conceivable theoretical constitutional possibility. Our next call is from Amber in California.
I was just calling to say thank you for your voice. I really love listening to your show. And also, you were commenting about how Vice President Biden is more of a centrist, and you hope that the Senate is controlled by more centrist Democrats. And Biden did say that he won the nomination based on the fact that he was more center than the rest of the Democrats running, and yet he picked Kamala Harris as his running mate. I just don't understand that. She is not a centrist. She is more towards the left. She wasn't even a good candidate. And that's not really important anymore, since he did win the nomination and he will most likely be the next president. But I feel like in some ways there's some contradictions, or it doesn't really make sense how you can say Biden is this way, but he chose the complete opposite as his vice presidential pick. So I don't know that he's going to pick that way when it comes to his cabinet and the things he's going to appoint in his time as president.
That's a very, very good point. Very often, presidential candidates pick people who represent a different wing of the party from themselves. John Kennedy picked Lyndon Johnson, who he didn't like. He didn't expect that Lyndon Johnson would ever become president, but of course, we know what happened. I think when Joe Biden made his decision who he was going to pick for vice president, he had two considerations in mind. Number one, and probably the most important, who will help him win the presidency? But clearly, the second consideration was who might replace me. He's, after all, the oldest person ever to be sworn in as president of the United States. The statistics indicate that there is at least some chance he may not survive 4 years as president. I sure hope he does, because 4 years from now he'll be exactly my age. And I hope the demographics go beyond 82, which is what he'll be. But clearly she has a good chance of becoming president, if not during Biden's term. If Biden decides not to run for re-election, she would have the inside track, vice presidents often do, for getting the nomination for president. Where I think I don't agree with you is her political stand. I think she's somewhat further left ideologically than Biden. I think that may be partly a generational issue. younger people within the Democratic Party are somewhat more to the left, but she's not a hard leftist. She is not what you would, she doesn't fit into the camp of the progressives who deny free speech, deny due process, think they know it all. She was, after all, a prosecutor. And in fact, some of the criticism that she got was that she was too tough, and that sometimes she wasn't sensitive enough to the concerns of the African-American community, though she is part of that community. So he made his choice. I think his cabinet will consist of people representing all wings of the party. He may very well consider Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren as part of his cabinet. But remember, He's the president. Cabinets are way overrated in their influence and power, particularly cabinet members like, you know, Secretary of Labor and Secretary of the Interior. The key cabinet positions are always going to be Treasury and State and Homeland Security and issues of that kind, commerce, perhaps. But we have to wait and see. I suspect that we'll see a center-left presidency, much like Obama's presidency, not as anti-Israel as Obama's presidency turned out to be in the end, but that's what the people voted for. 5 million more people voted for the Biden-Harris ticket than for the Trump-Pence ticket. That's the way democracy works. The Electoral College, he seems to have about 300 electoral votes, many of them contested and challenged. But as you say, he will probably be the next president of the United States. And I think he'll govern from the center left. Our next call is also from California. Jonathan.
How will a potential Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, president and VP, impact the Taylor Force Act and the current status quo in the Middle East?
Great. Thank you for the question. The Taylor Force Act, of course, is named after a great American soldier and hero who was walking in Tel Aviv, in a place where I walk all the time with my family, and a Palestinian terrorist murdered him in cold blood just because he was in Israel. And the United States Congress passed a law limiting, conditioning any kind of support for the Palestinians on them rescinding their pay-to-slay policy. The person who murdered a great American soldier was paid by the Palestinian Authority. His family was paid. And it incentivizes killing, and it rewards killing. And I would think that a President Biden would not change that. He might want to engage more with the Palestinians. He may want to open up the Palestinian consulate or whatever it's called, delegation in Washington. I have no problem with that. He may want to return some economic aid to the Palestinians. And maybe he can persuade them to sit down finally and negotiate with Israel. Remember, Israel has offered to negotiate with the Palestinians over the Trump plan, over other plans. They offered it in 2000, 2001. They offered it in 2008. They've offered it ever since. And the Palestinians don't know how to take yes for an answer and never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. I would hope that a President Biden would continue to put pressure on the Palestinians, not on the Israelis. The Israelis don't need pressure. They want peace. They want a negotiated solution. The majority of Israelis favor a two-state solution as long as the Palestinian state doesn't pose a security threat to Israel and is disarmed and allows for Israeli military presence in the Jordan Valley. Those are all reasonable conditions. You could have a contiguous, viable Palestinian state. If anybody doesn't think a Palestinian state is viable, just visit Ramallah. It's a beautiful city. It looks like downtown Jerusalem, has wonderful stores. People are driving nice cars and electronic shops, and you don't ever see an Israeli soldier or policeman. It is a Palestinian mini state already. They vote for their own city officials. It's a model of what a Palestinian state could look like if only the Palestinians would accept compromise. Just this week, the Palestinians lost their chief negotiator, Saeed Barakat, who I knew and had dinner with and met on numerous occasions, and he was somebody who was very, very tough negotiator. But in the end, I think he understood that a negotiated peace is what will get the Palestinians to a state, not the BDS movement, not UN resolutions, not protests on college campuses, but sitting down and negotiating. And it's President Trump did a lot to move it in that direction by telling the Palestinians, essentially, you're not the only game in town here. Israel can make peace with the Emirates. Israel can make peace with other countries. You have to come and sit down at the negotiating table. I would hope that that legacy could be continued by President Biden. Our next call is from my favorite place in the world, Brooklyn, New York.
My question is regarding censorship by big tech. And the question is, regardless of if we achieve to make them liable with amending Section 230. But is it fair to say that being that they're a publicly traded company in the U.S., they should have to abide by the Constitution? And if they censor and limit the freedom of speech, they should be thrown off Wall Street.
Well, the Constitution, the First Amendment, doesn't apply to publicly traded corporations. The New York Times is a publicly traded corporation. Many media companies are publicly traded, and they have the right to be wrong. And the New York Times exercises the right to be wrong every single day. And it's a tragedy because they have can no longer claim to be the newspaper of record. They're so opinionated and biased in the way they present the news, putting aside their editorials. But publicly traded media companies are not covered by the First Amendment, except insofar as the government can't regulate them. They are not obligated to present all sides of the issue. The real question is, could Congress pass a statute saying that because the social media is so important and affects interstate commerce and affects everything, that they are subject to certain rules? That's a hard question under the First Amendment. We know that they could either rescind Section 230, which gives them immunity, which they're not entitled to under the First Amendment. Congress could either rescind Section 230 or could condition it and say, look, if you want to be a platform, just a platform, and you get benefits of 230, fine. But if you start censoring and picking and choosing what you're going to put on your platform, then you're like the New York Times. The New York Times doesn't have any immunity. If the New York Times defames somebody, that person has the right to sue them. And people have sued the New York Times. And I'm suing CNN right now. They have no immunity. And they have to respond to my lawsuit because they defamed me by making me say, by doctoring a recording of my argument in front of the Senate, where I said a president could be impeached if he did anything illegal. They doctored the tape to have me say a president could not be impeached if he did anything illegal. And then they had their lackeys on the air repeat that and say, oh, Alan Dershowitz says a president can't be impeached even if he does illegal things, when I said exactly the opposite. So I'm suing them. They have no immunity. If they were just a platform like Google or Twitter, they would have immunity. And so there is a possibility of making them choose between being a platform in which they do not express opinions and do not censor, or being a publishing house like the New York Times or CNN, where they are free to say whatever they want and censor whoever they want, but they don't get immunity. That's their choice, and Congress ought to put it to them directly. Our next call is from Ruvain.
What if the courts decide that the court in Pennsylvania was wrong to give the extension on the mail-in ballots, but the fact is that people relied on that court ruling to give the extension, and that's why they mailed it in late? Should that be taken into account at all?
That's a great question. The court will rule, if it came to the court, that the Supreme Court of the United States will rule that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania exceeded its authority by extending the time for counting ballots 3 days beyond the end of Election Day. They will so rule, I believe. It would be a 5-4, perhaps a partisan vote, maybe 6-3. But I think that ruling would come down. The question then is, would a person who relied on that 3-day extension have the right to go to court and say, look, but I shouldn't suffer from that, I played by the rules? That's certainly a possibility. Hard to say how one relies on the 3-day extension, because these are people who got their votes in on time. It's just the post office screwed up, or somebody screwed up. So the reliance interest would be a hard one to make, but they would have an even stronger claim. They say they played by the rules. They got it in by 2 o'clock on Election Day. Why should their vote not be counted just because somebody messed up and didn't get it to the proper authorities? The mail didn't get it to them on time. It would be an interesting litigation. I think it's moot because the number of ballots that come within the category of that situation are less than the number of ballots separating the winner from the loser in the election. So I don't think we'll ever get to have a decision on that issue. So let's turn now to our next caller.
Hey, Alan, big fan of yours, been a big fan since the O.J. Simpson case. You did so well defending Trump during the impeachment trial. Your brilliance honestly knows no bounds. I just want to applaud you for the work that you're doing for our President Donald J. Trump.
Well, thank you so much. I did the same work for Bill Clinton. I didn't appear on the floor of the Senate, but I did help his legal defense team, and I would do the same thing if President Biden were to be impeached on unconstitutional grounds. I also appeared in the Senate on behalf of Senator Alan Cranston, a liberal Democrat. So I don't pick my clients, certainly clients in these political type cases, based on who I voted for or my partisan preferences. I pick them based on whether I believe the Constitution was violated. And the Constitution was plainly violated with the impeachment of Donald Trump. He did not commit treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And those are the only criteria for impeachment under the Constitution. He wasn't even accused of those crimes. He was accused of abuse of power, which 44 American presidents have been accused of. He was accused of obstruction of Congress, which is make-believe. Who knows what that means? He exercised his constitutional rights under Article 2 to refuse to provide information to Congress that was covered by executive privilege. So neither of those grounds that the House impeached him on were constitutionally authorized. That's why I opposed impeachment and defended the president. I did it on principle, and I'll continue to conduct my career based on principles, even though it will not win me any popularity contests. Well, that's all for today, folks, on The Dirt Show. I'm still anxious to hear from Reverend Warnock, who is running for the Senate in Georgia and whose election would perhaps turn the Senate over to the Democrats. I've issued him an invitation. I'd like him to appear on this show and explain how he could have signed a statement and made a sermon that was so virulently anti-Israel. Now he claims he's changed his views. I want to hear about those changes. And so hopefully he'll be on the show. And if not, we'll hear your views on the Reverend Warnock and on other political, legal, and controversial issues on The Dirt Show, the show which will never, ever bore you. An important part of The Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.